accession number 6388, rail 2.
Colonel Dibbons, rail 2.
On the night of the 9th, 10th of May, 1940, the town of Douai was bombed quite heavily. And the house I was living in was, of course, disturbed, to say the least. On the morning, the following morning, the 10th, I reported as usual to my headquarters, and there was an upsurge of excitement. At around 10 o'clock that day, my assistant provost marshal called me in and he said, "You and your two subordinates have got to go back to Le Mans." So I went and told my fellows, and I said, "Well, I'm not going back if I can avoid it. There's a vacancy in the military police for a lieutenant, 102 Pavot Company." And so I went back to the major, and I said, "But sir, there is a vacancy in 102 Pavot Company for a lieutenant, and I would like to take up that post."
"Why did you want that? Why did you want that post?"
"Because it was going to take me to the forward areas."
"Why did you want to go forward?"
"Because I wanted to be in the fighting zone." I'm a little bit aggressive, or I was, you know. But having said so, yes, I wanted to be in the battle if there was going to be one. And frankly, I thought, well, if this is it, we're going through to Berlin, I might as well be with the boys and get congratulated when we got to Berlin. Let me put it that way. I heard that sound on tape, I'm sure, but that's not it. So he said, "Well, I can't give authority, but I'll have to go to headquarters and see the one of the brigadiers, who later was a General Halstead." And he went and saw this officer, this very senior officer, and came back and said, "Yes, you can take up the post." When I told my two fellows, the sergeant major and the sergeant, that I was going over to the Red Caps, I said, "Well, we're not going back to Le Mans." I said, "You do as you're told." I said, "Well, we're just not. We're going to hide ourselves and we're going to follow on with the company. I'm not going to give you any names." I accepted this. The place was, you know, not disorganised, but anyway, they both had motorcycles. I had a little Austin 7 Tourer, camouflaged, open. So at 10 o'clock at... No, cancel. At roughly 2 o'clock, we started the company, the 102 Pavot Company, prepared to get on the move. And we left Douai at roughly 8:30 at night. I was the last in the van, so I was the last officer, certainly. We had a captain, we had a major, who was the APM. He had an assistant called the deputy assistant provost marshal. There was a captain in command of the company, and I was his lieutenant, and I was the last of the van. As we came into darkness, I followed the route and I followed, you know, I mean, we were moving fairly slowly, obviously, 10 miles an hour and cobbled roads and whatever. As we ran into darkness, they had someone, I don't know who, had put down little night lights along the side of the road so you could follow the route. I had a Batman, by the way, who shared my car with me. And when we'd gone, perhaps, I don't know, midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, no lights on the vehicles. My eyes were like pinpoints, and I saw trees in front of me. This is fact. I stopped the car, got out, and there were no trees at all. I was losing touch with my company at this stage. My eyes were being pulled out. Anyway, I caught them up. These little lights were sufficient to follow a trail. And then we settled down in... I don't know whether I've got the name of the place there. But we settled down in a village and, at perhaps 3 o'clock in the morning.
Was this place called Grammont?
Could be. If I mentioned it before.
I thought I saw in your notes that it was called
probably,
Grammont.
Probably, yeah. And we went, the company, some of them, slept in a form of coffee house. Because I remember they had a machine there, not a one-armed bandit, but that type of thing there, music machine, I think it was. Organ, something like that. And anyway, we were away again at 7 o'clock in the morning. We stayed, we bivouacked somewhere else en route because I was billeted in a little old farmhouse for that night. Quite uncomfortable. More than uncomfortable. But anyway, that's my story. And then we moved early in the morning, perhaps 7 o'clock, and went on to the outskirts of Brussels.
That had been your intended objective,
yeah,
had
it? Yes, that was our objective. We were intending to go farther than that, as far as I knew. But then I was just a two-pipper who wouldn't know, really, what the so-called battle plan would be at that stage.
So you were intended to go right up the front?
Forward areas, up to the Dutch border, I take it. But, of course, Jerry had moved so fast that within my company, I went into Brussels to see what the situation was in Brussels with my captain, see what military police were required there. Came back, the body of the company was billeted in a school. There was a billeting officer attached to corps, and he found me a billet in a private house. And the people there were quite charming. Of course, we're in Belgium now, and you may know the Belgians are more friendly than the French are, but that's just important. And I went back to the company, and then I had dinner with these people. It was a pleasant evening. I'd been shown my room, and I went to bed because I'd had very little sleep for the past 3 nights, if not 4 nights. And I was truly shocked when I wakened in the morning, which was then possibly about 7:15. The house had been abandoned. The water had been cut off. The electricity had been cut off. I assumed they couldn't waken me. No. I was the only one in the house. I found enough drips out of the tap to get a shave. And I dressed as hurriedly as I could and found my way, and I was lucky to do that, to find this school. But I found the school, and my boys were then on the move. And this was 8 o'clock in the morning, backwards, in retreat. We then pulled in. Perhaps we moved 30, 40 miles, kilometres, if you like. And we were put up in a convent, an abandoned convent. Oh, yes, what I'm missing out at the moment is all these civilians on the roads. Refugees. Literally tens of thousands of them. The roads were blocked. I mean, we just couldn't get... They were going out and our troops were trying to come up. And we, as military police, had a deuce of a job trying to get a room for the vehicles to come forward with the troops.
Was that one of the jobs the military police had to
they
do?
They had to help, certainly do a lot, but I mean, much depended on the number of police we had available at that time. The military police were divided up into sections, and they were posted to certain core units to look after that particular section, so we didn't have a complete company with us all the time. Can you follow this? Company was about 120 men. And a section was 16 men. And having said that to you, there were 8 sections, I think, in a company section. I think probably 9 sections in all. You're testing my memory a lot, you know. But, yes, we were deeply involved with the refugee problem. And one thing that I shall never forget, one sad... what's the word I want? Not experience. Sight. One very sad sight was a woman, an old woman, in a three-wheeled pram being pushed by her daughter. And the body in the just her backside was sitting in the pram, and her head was over there, and her feet were down there, and he had three wheels on this pram, and this woman was trying to push this thing away from the onslaught of the Germans. That was, I think, it still isn't there, you know. But we encountered serious difficulties with them.
Had you been told which direction to retreat in, or did you just choose the direction yourself?
No, we were under orders. We had a direction. I wasn't necessarily told. I was just normally my job as lieutenant was at the rear of the company, and I just followed the rest because I don't recall being told where we were going. I might have been, but I don't recall it. We didn't have, the company didn't have much contact, or very little contact, with the assistant of a marshal. He was very much corps staff.
What rank was he?
A major. And my job, I was directly responsible to the captain commanding the company. And if he didn't tell me, I wouldn't know. I mean, I just followed the van and saw that we didn't have any... loose chaps hanging around or wasting their time or whatever. Most of our people were travelling on motorcycles. We had probably 8 1500-weight trucks which packed all their gear. We had road signs and that sort of thing, you see.
So what happened next once you set off for this destination?
We got this convent and we settled in there perhaps at 4 or 5 o'clock at night. I slept in the main hall of this convent because there was no billeting accommodation in those days. I knew nothing about tents anyway. But there were no tents as far as I know. If the general, I assume, and his immediate staff were in a chateau somewhere, their communications were signal people put on a line between the headquarters staff and this school, this convent where I was, telephone line, because I probably ate with the men whatever we had. It was bully beef and biscuits or something on those lines. There was no cooked meals going. One thing that I recall also again vividly was that there was a piano in this main room, and our fellas, or one of our fellas, was playing Roll Out the Barrel, which was a song, you know, very common in those days, and Run Rabbit Run, and the shells were coming over the top of the place, and I thought, this is rather marvellous, you know, boost the morale. Which I think it did. Anyway, we turned in. I turned in, and the others must have done, because I wouldn't have turned in before they did. I had a sleeping bag sort of business, you see, sleeping roll. And I was fairly well looked after. My batman was still with me. And so he'd fix up the bed for me and whatever, you know. I didn't have to do those bits and pieces. And at 2 o'clock, or roughly 2 o'clock, I got a shake. Wake up, sir, business, you see. And it was a corporal that I knew, and I told him to go back to sleep. But he didn't give me any peace. Another sort of quarter of an hour, he was back at it again. He said, they want you on the phone at headquarters. And by this time I was awake, alert. So I got on the phone, and they told me that we were to pack up all our bits and pieces and away at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Where to?
Oh, now you ask me. I don't know. It could have been to a place called Ask, A-S-C-Q. But before this, possibly we had a day there, because my major came to me and he said, I want you to take your sergeant. He knew the sergeant major was with us at this stage. That was my own sergeant major. He knew they'd stayed with the company at this stage. He didn't criticise me or anything. He knew they were there, because he said, you better take your sergeant major. And I want you to find two routes where we can carry 6-inch guns and heavy transport. And I want two new routes. And of course I had a plan, you know, a map. And he and I, this was before they wakened me at 2 o'clock in the morning. This sergeant major and I went around in my car, and we found two very good, what we regarded as two very good routes, which were not being used by the refugees during this particular day. And we got back to this school at 9 o'clock that night. And it was at 2 o'clock they called me. Now, can you follow this? And anyway, having got this instruction from headquarters, and I don't know who was on the phone, I never asked, you bother about asking things like that in those days. I got the company together, and they packed up the bits and pieces, and the trucks were ready, and off we moved. And I think it was then we went to this place called Ask.
What did you do there?
Well, that was an extraordinary place. We settled in. Of course, you realise we're regulating traffic on the road as best we can. That was part of the drill of the military police. Because half my company were AA scouts, territorial soldiers, and AA scouts. This is quite important to me, because they were great, great chaps. They were the right people for the right job. They knew how to regulate traffic, and they knew how to repair vehicles, and minor repairs anyway. So they were kept very, very fully occupied on both sides of the house, directing traffic and trying to direct the refugees out of the way and whatever. But when we got to Ask, we settled in there. I think we settled in a farmhouse. Our Air Force, shot down two German planes. And in one German plane, there were two dead Germans, and the plane was alight, ablaze, and we couldn't do anything with it, and I had to provide a guard around the plane to keep the onlookers away, other soldiers, I take it. We didn't have any civilians. We did have civilians still there, because the farmer came to me later that day, and he gave me a brace of pigeons, you know, for a meal or something. And then he went. But he left his cattle behind, because they were mooing so loudly, they badly wanted milked, and obviously the poor beasts were in agony, because they should have been milked. We had these planes down, and we obviously stayed there that night. Then we...
Well, were the German crews killed in the planes?
These two were burned to death. Horrible smell. Like, I can remember it now. The other two were taken prisoner. I'm going ahead a bit.
Can you remember what type of planes they were?
No, I couldn't tell. Fighters. That's all I could tell. I couldn't tell. It's a bit hazy, aren't I? We stopped just the other side of Toulon before this. Because I think before Ask, I think we stopped the other side of Toulon. The French side of Toulon, the river's there. Because I was instructed to go back to my headquarters. There was a general's conference on, and I was instructed to again take my sergeant major and go back to Corps headquarters up in the battle area, very much in the battle area, and tell this brigadier in particular, or get a message to the general, or generals, that's Lord Gorton, is the corps commanders, obviously, divisional commanders as well. They were generals. Corps commanders were lieutenant generals, and divisional commanders were major generals. That there was only one bridge out of three remaining at Toulon. That was the message I had to impart, which in fact I didn't. I saw the brigadier who gave me the authority to take up this post with the military police.
Was this place called Toulon or Tourcoing?
Toulon. T-O-U-L-O-N. That's right, isn't it? I'm not getting it mixed up with a port down on by Marseille.
Well, there is a port near Marseille called Toulon.
I've got it wrong then. Got it wrong.
There is a place called Tourcoing and another place called Tournai.
Not
Tournai.
Tournai, probably. Tournai. I imagine it would be in this. We went to this, this sergeant major and I went to this place and I saw the brigadier and he gave me further instructions to stop a troop train perhaps some 20 kilometres from this general's gathering, meeting, and tell the colonel in charge, and he was a full colonel, that the troops were to be sent back. They weren't to stay, the train was to be turned round and the whole body of troops were to go back, which I did. In the meantime, or during this time, we were being machine-gunned and whatever from the air.
With casualties?
Not to me. Obviously, I'm here. I don't mean it that way. I don't mean that stupidly. You asked me a question. I didn't see any. These fighters were coming across, machine-gun in the roads and whatever. We nearly got blown up in my little car, but that's another part of the story. Within my knowledge, without casualties at that moment of time. I don't know what happened to the train. I left as soon as I'd given this direction to this full colonel. I couldn't get away quickly enough. It was a bit hazardous, to say the least. And when we got back to Tournai, you're right, absolutely right. Thank goodness you pulled me up there. The place was blocked with military transport. And my son major and I got out and we started and I wore the armband, military police armband, and I suppose he did something similar. But between us we got some sort of order into disorder, out of disorder. And we got this thing running smoothly. It was blocked at one time, because you see, I'm sure you'll appreciate this, trucks turned over, there was all sorts of things. When the enemy planes came over, the driver lost control, he turned the damn truck over or something. I mean, I'm not blaming him, I'm just trying to give you some idea of what was happening at the time. It was some... What shall I say? I mean, I've read about the Falklands, and I can assure you we had nearly as bad a time as they did. But anyway, we got this thing, we got this convoy, or convoys moving over this bridge, and we went back and got back to our location. Yet roughly, I know it was 2:30 in the morning, because there was a corporal waiting up for me, and he made us some tea. And then I think it was from there we moved on to Armentières. Armentières was devastated. I've never seen so many hose pipes attached to hydrants not being used in my life. It was like a bed of snakes. Buildings were, we suffered almost continuous bombing there. And at that time, one and two corps headquarters were within the city boundaries. The Germans hit the lunatic asylum, They broke the wall, for starts, you see, and so we had lunatics all over the place. We people were involved in trying to keep some semblance of order and trying to keep some the convoys moving. And we had a number of German POWs. We did, the military police did.
What type of attitude did they have?
Oh, a couple of young Air Force officers were most difficult, to say the least. Bumptious people. They were, you know, flight boots and whatever. And really, when I gave them instruction, they didn't, well, they did take notes to me because I was bigger than they were. But they're all truly, truly bumptious, aggressive. We're the bosses, you know, you can't do anything to the Germans, sort of thing.
Did they try to escape?
Not whilst I was there, no. I don't know what happened. When we eventually got rid of them, which was on the, must have been the Friday night, I can give you days because, you see, I remember the Saturday and I remember the Sunday we moved out of our, I moved out of Armentieres. This is why I'm able to give you days. A truck, when I got back from one of these reconnaissance trips, I found that there was a troop carrying truck outside with a hood. I suppose they all had hoods, I'm not sure. But and they were loading these German prisoners into this truck. And they, these two officers were at the sitting on wooden stools, which you get in a barrack room or whatever, you know. And they were sitting at the tail end. And the chap they had to guard them, and I just couldn't believe it. I might have had two, but one in particular was armed with a rifle. With that lot, none of them were. They weren't bound in any way. They were just sitting there.
How many were there about?
30 to 40. And the school where we had these people was bombed, and one of my chaps was killed, and I wasn't very pleased with the Germans, to say the least, let alone these two officers who started to indicate to me that they were in charge and I wasn't. So nearby there were some signal folk laying some cables through somewhere or other. This cable, thicker than this, of course, but telephone cables. So I said, let me have some of that cable, which in fact they did, and I put a half hitch round each of these chaps' wrists, plus the officers. And they complained very bitterly, you can't do this to me. I said, that's what you think, that's what's happening to you. And I lashed them to the side of the trolley, of the van, you see. So I've got all these chaps then sat down the two sides of this. In fact, I can't remember where they were sitting at that end, but they were sitting the two sides, and they all had their hands together with a half inch, so if they pulled, it gives this chap with a rifle some chance to do something, because as far as I was concerned, without a pistol, he needed a pistol if he was going to shoot anybody. He couldn't shoot anybody in a vehicle, in a troop-carrying truck with a rifle. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it.
Were the other POWs Army men or Air Force?
Army, in the main. The only POWs I saw, Air Force, were pilots or their navigators. I didn't see any other German prisoners of war other than the pilot and his navigator.
Did the other POWs, the army POWs, seem to be arrogant as well?
No, no trouble at all. They were soldiers, and by our standards, private soldiers, probably. I mean, there might have been a corporal or so with them. I wouldn't know that. But they were in no way arrogant. They were disciplined. And they did as they were told. And they didn't object when I got their wrists wired together.
Well, what condition did they seem to be in?
Very good. No problem. They weren't unkempt, and they were well fed, seemingly. We fed them, of course, possibly.
Were there any wounded amongst them?
No. No, they would have been taken. If had they been wounded, they would have been taken into our hospitals. Or casualty clearing stations, as the case may be.
So what happened next?
Well, then they set off, and obviously I never saw them again. Well, then, if you...
I think there's one incident that you'd like to recount that happened on the Saturday morning.
Yes. We had by this time obviously, as I said, got rid of the prisoners of war. And it was then my job to go scouting around the city to find routes to get the heavy vehicles, in particular, through to the battlefront. And whilst I was doing this with a sergeant of mine, and his name was Stott. All right. We saw all these hundreds of, really hundreds, or it seemed hundreds of hydrants